welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 184, and of course with me, as always this week, are James.
Hey.
Greg.
Ahoy hoy.
And not John. John is taking care of his wife tonight.
Everybody.
Whoa, what was that?
I'm John.
Oh.
Just doing a John.
You actually sounded like it for a sec. It kind of freaked
me out. I
like
this John better.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty good.
That voice belongs to Michael T.Y.P. Cole.
I like the very, very curt endings to the words.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect.
Can we keep this, John?
You can tell we've both edited him in a podcast before, by the way, on this conversation.
Indeed.
Well, he's only been on my show once, though. So.
I know, but still
it only takes once.
That's a little inside Lindemann, you know. So, John will be back next week. I believe he'll be talking about Disaster Day of Crisis when he gets back, among other things.
That's a tease. There
I know.
There you go.
Tune in next week, same bat time, same bat channel.
That's right. So, yeah, it's TYP, and of course, TYP is the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, and we actually recorded an episode together at my place last weekend. So, yeah, TYP came for a little vacation, kind of a long weekend. I have to say, he was here for 4 days, and we skied two of those all day.
Jam.
Yeah, so there wasn't as much gaming as you might think when the two of us get together, because we actually have other common interests as well. But, well, TYP, I wanted to let you go ahead and start off new business since you're the special guest this week.
Well, I should mention that on the flight out, I started playing Professor Layton, the second one, Diabolical Box. I hadn't played the original. I was kind of scared by the puzzly aspects to it, and I'm enjoying it so far. I've only put in about an hour, but it's clever. I don't like the feeling of feeling stupid because of the tricky nature of some of the puzzles.
Yeah.
But I like the storytelling. I like the plot so far, and it just sort of has a very good presentation overall. I'm really enjoying that. But yeah, damn. I mean, that sliding block puzzle. I hate those sliding block puzzles. So.
Yeah. The problem is they just don't go away. And they just keep coming back, and they just keep getting worse.
Oh, really? I wish you hadn't told me that.
Well,
and now
they're better. They're better in
it.
Two. In the first game, there's one that I almost cracked my DS in half about.
Well, I'm glad I'm in good company then. let's see. What else did I play? I played a bunch of stuff at Johnny's place. I got to check out a bunch of games I haven't really played yet, like Uncharted 2, which is probably on the short list now. I enjoyed it enough that I want to check it out, which says a lot because I really didn't like the demo. I was one of the people that really hated the demo for the original.
Mm-hmm.
I got to check out Flower a little bit. I played the first level or so of Flower. It's curious. it's a little bit aimless. It looks very pretty.
She's not like the other girls.
Although parts of it felt kind of like Sonic at the second half of the first level.
Mm-hmm. I do think there's some Sonic the Hedgehog in there, oddly enough. I really do.
What else? We actually dusted off Brawl and played a bunch of that.
Yeah, that was probably the most fun that we had. I feel like we played that for like 2 hours, and we were unlocking a lot of characters, because this will come up later when we get to retroactive. But a couple years ago, I had to send in my Wii for repairs, and they wiped the memory. So, you know, I was able to re-download a lot of WiiWare and Virtual Console stuff, but I lost some of my save files. And for a lot of games, I didn't really care. But for Super Mario RPG, it sucked when I finally went back to it. And for Brawl, it sucked because those characters take a long time to unlock. So we're still catching up. Yeah.
So what we did was we decided to play Brawls in 1 minute matches so that we rack up matches. We figured, like, well, this will be kind of lame, only doing 1 minute. But it turned out it was a lot of fun. It was a short, almost like every battle was almost like a sudden death.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a lot of fun because, you know, I get to play with a different character every time. And I mean, that game it's still got it.
Yeah, I nearly play that every week with a friend of mine still.
That's
really?
Excellent.
And I play Melee every week before that. So
Yeah,
so not to lead anyone as to what they should vote for, but...
Yeah, I'm jealous, Greg, that you have someone to play with that regularly, because it's a rare treat for me when people come visit or something like that, or when we go to E3. And I always have a blast. I still think Smash Brothers, just as a series, is they're some of the funniest games ever, and they really don't have a lick of dialogue. It's just these situations, they throw all this random, not random, carefully chosen, bizarre stuff.
It's buffoonery.
And there's so many great interactions, you know, between, among all the different characters and items and levels and moves and people who actually play them. And I just always end up busting a gut laughing when I play Smash Brothers. And it's, a lot of it is, you're making your own comedy.
Yeah, especially if you've got some brilliantly timed feats of ineptitude.
Yeah.
It always be really funny. That is often the funniest stuff. Just some huge calamity. And of course, for me, bumpers plus the soccer ball.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yes.
There was something that we did that just busted a gut, but I can't remember what it is now for the life of me. There was just...
I don't know. There were several moments for me that I was just laughing so hard, but... Yeah, we played some new Super Mario Brothers Wii also, which was
That's really right. Nice. We got a chance to check out more of the coin battle system. I'd only kind of tried one or two levels for my review, and I was impressed with the rest of the coin battle levels. There are a few levels that are unique to the coin battle mode, and those are really well done.
It was my first time playing any of those. I had kind of forgotten, or I'm not even sure if I was ever fully aware, that there were special levels just for that mode. And they're actually really good. They're, I would say, some of the best levels in the game.
Yeah, like one of them is like a bizarre version of like the first level from the original Super Mario Brothers. But it's like, it's bizarre. There's like, it throws crazy shit at you. Like there are areas that are not solid platforms, and things pop out from the background and rotate up.
Yeah.
And so it's like, at first it looks like the original Mario Brothers level, and then...
It's really not at all. Yeah, there's a vertically scrolling level where you even find Yoshi... and penguin suits and propellers all over the place. There's really a lot of fun stuff. It's a lot of the best elements of the main part of the game, just kind of condensed a little bit more. We had a really good time with it.
Yeah, that's good.
That was nice. It's the first time I've played Mario in a couple of months, actually, because again, I don't really have that many people who come over and play games that often.
Yeah, I should probably pry myself away from Brawl once to try the coin battle a bit more than I did originally. It just played more of the actual, like, the co-op single play, if you like, you know.
It reminded me a bit of the battle mode in the DS New Super Mario Brothers, which
I think
is really fun mode in the DS game, and it's very limited because there's only two or three levels that you can play with it. But if you really like the Wii game and you own the DS game and you never played the multiplayer on that, you should really go back and try it because it's set up. I mean, it's obviously the inspiration for all the multiplayer in the Wii game. And it's really fun even on DS. So we played some Tatsunoko. I think you were even more perplexed by it than I am.
Part of the problem is that I don't play fighting games. I don't play traditional fighting games.
I don't
games
really and, either. Yeah.
And this game's a little closer to that in terms of presentation, in terms of of some of the moves. I mean, it isn't totally like Street Fighter or whatever, but it feels different from like Smash Brothers in terms of how you control it. And of course, I'm only familiar with maybe a third of the characters at best.
Yeah, me too. Even some of the Capcom characters.
No, they really obscure some of the Capcom ones.
Yeah. What the hell's up with the zombie guy? Seriously.
Frank West. No, that's one of the ones I actually sort of recognize. He's from Dead Rising.
Yeah.
Right, but the moves he has, they're just...
Yeah, he's just
hilarious.
Weird. He really is.
I don't get... This game definitely does not take itself seriously, which I definitely appreciate.
Yeah.
But I really couldn't figure out how to play it. Oh, it was a button masher for me.
Yeah. It kind of is for me, too. I mean... I guess I'm more familiar with fighting games than you are probably, Mike, but I don't really play them that often, and that's a game that has been sitting in my Wii for like 2 weeks, and I don't play it that much because, I mean, I like it, but especially without having someone else who's of a similar skill level to really, you know, we can bounce off of each other a bit. The single player's not good.
That's what you need, ideally, is you need someone else to play with that you're going to kind of grow together.
Right.
Because there's depth to that game, however silly it may be on the surface. But you're not going to exploit it if it's only ever like, oh, this showing someone it for the first time. But you can enjoy it showing them for the first time because there's so much crazy stuff in it. But beyond that, it's going to be difficult, which is why it's good they've got the online mode in there, but I don't really know how well that holds up.
Well, and I think part of... I mean, I only rented it briefly and played it, but part of what I think comes out of this game is that a lot of the depth comes from how do you pair your characters together and things, because you get two, and you probably would need one to complement the other, but I haven't been able to figure out what's the best way to do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, when you get to sort of the more advanced techniques, there's, like, moves you can do where you can force people to tag out, and all sorts of stuff, you know, which kind of brings into play more like what your team actually is, you know, like where you feel like I want to force the other player in and then I'll use this attack that's going to work more effectively on them or something, you know, that's kind of where it's going to go ultimately, but you won't get there unless you've got someone to kind of go on that journey with you, because the single player is not going to entice enough for you to develop those skills on your own, probably.
Yeah, and, you know, it does have online play, but the very limited experience I have with it so far is just that you're not going to learn to play the game that way. You know, that's something maybe for when you've already attained a high level and you feel like you know, the computer poses no threat to you, you need to go online and play somebody with different tactics. Then that's what that would be for. But like for casual player matching, I just want a pickup game, you know, so far I haven't had that experience with Tatsunoko versus Capcom. And rarely do you have that experience with any online game, quite frankly. It's just kind of one of the pitfalls of the form, and very few developers seem to really care. And I think, you know, with the Wii's matchup system, it may not even be possible to do a whole lot with that. Do you remember the old Mario Kart DS commercials where they're like, these are different kinds of people. That wasn't true on Mario Kart DS, and it's less true with most other online games.
I prefer the Japanese ones that had a lot of national stereotypes in it.
That's right. You got paired up with people in Mario Kart DS based on whether or not you had a Mario Kart DS. So if you had it, you got dropped in you're paired with these people. Otherwise, you just weren't playing it. Because I don't think I ever won a match of Mario Kart DS online. And you think eventually they would have said, hey, maybe he's not very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it changed a lot, didn't it, as well? It was kind of good to start with, or in my experience, and then not long after release, it kind of got
snakes the game.
Yeah, the play group always evolves over time.
Into the willing and the unwilling.
Basically.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of online gaming. It just, I can't get into it. Maybe it's because I haven't done a lot of like co-op with friends, and I don't have a system that really will facilitate that, or games that will facilitate that. But to me, I've just never really figured out what the appeal was. I mean,
well, it depends on the game too. But anyway, this tangent's gone on long enough.
Yeah. One final thing I wanted to mention up was I got a chance to play a little bit of Splosion Man, and that's a lot of fun. It's a really clever little game, and I think the right word for its personality is mayhem. But if you don't have a chance to play it, you should at least hunt down the credits to that
the
game,
ending.
Because
it is. Although I would say if you're going to actually play it, don't spoil it. But if you know that you're not going to have any chance to play this, to play Splosion Man on Xbox, go ahead and look up, I would say go on YouTube and look for the final boss plus ending video, because the final boss is definitely worth watching, especially some of the stuff that happens towards the end of that battle. And then the video that plays during the ending is something to behold, really.
Yeah.
It is. But it is. TYP and I were both just cracking up watching it on YouTube. But I showed him Braid, which I don't know, what'd you think of that?
I was kind of underwhelmed by it, but maybe I just didn't really play enough of it to get the concept. It seems very cerebral.
Yeah.
But you know, when you look at it, it looks like a platformer, but it doesn't really have the controls of a platformer or really the level design of a platformer, but there's some interesting ideas there. I don't think I'd buy the game. I think I've seen enough of it.
Yeah, I showed you a pretty diverse set of levels from Braid, and let's see, we also played Kirby's Dream Course. That's what I wanted to mention.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised you wanted to bring that up, because we didn't really get a chance to... I didn't really get a chance to show you how to play that darn game.
Well, I mean, I watched you. I've tried playing that. I mean, I've sunk a couple hours into that game because you gifted it to me last year.
Yeah.
And I definitely understand what the goal of the game is, but the controls and the physics of it just don't make a whole lot of sense to me. And maybe it's just the timing of the meters that go up and down. You know, it's one of these, it's kind of like an old school golf game where you have this meter going up and down. You just have to time a button press.
It is an old school golf game, I guess.
Sort of.
No, it isn't. I'd say it's an old school golf game shoved into a puzzle game.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you really want to play the game
I've never played it, but don't you use Kirby's abilities, like the way he can absorb abilities to
that's
like
part
solve
of it.
How you're going to get to the hole?
That's part of it, but at the higher level, the idea is that you want to kind of survey the level and figure out what the best approach to it is. Mm-hmm.
A lot of it involves chipping Kirby high into the air and having him bounce around and ricochet off angled surfaces.
But you can plan it ahead. But you can plan some of this ahead of time because they have enough visual cues and everything where you can sort of plan out the perfect shot. And if you execute it just right, you can get a hole in one. And a lot of levels are designed to be completed a certain way,
right?
If you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I got that when I was playing it, but my problem is I can look at the level and say, oh, okay, here's the general approach that you want to take, but I can't actually execute it because I just find that the controls, the little dotted line that's supposed to show you where you're going to go, it seems like you rarely actually go where that line's going to say. And the control system's actually very well. From I have a hard time making it go that way.
Is it one of those ones where you have to time it right at the end for it to go straight?
No,
not really.
When you're putting spin on him or something like that, it's very tricky to get the right amount of power and the right amount of spin to actually get the shot that you set up. So a lot of times I would end up just taking like the simplest, easiest shot possible because at least I know what direction he's going to go in.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, once you put spin on it, especially on the ground, then it really depends on how hard you hit it. Because if you hit it like half speed, you're going to turn much tighter.
Yeah. It's
so
tough.
That's actually the trickiest thing. So I you don't usually want to use spin on the ground. It's rare that you want
but
to
I think
that.
TYP and I agree. It's probably the most difficult Kirby game.
Yeah, it is. But it's like, unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to play the multiplayer, which if you understand the physics, both players understand the physics of the game, it's a lot of fun because basically you're competing for the same stars. That's how you win. You get the most stars in a level.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of fun because you're trying to screw the other person over and everything.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun.
I played that game back when I was like 12 or 13 with my cousin, and once we got good at it, it basically just led to slamming the controller on the ground and running and walking off.
Yeah.
Because it was basically like, well, F you, man, and then he just walked off because he just screwed you over big time or the other way around.
Well, there's one world, there are like four courses in the multiplayer mode. One of them is called Mr. Shine and Mr. Bright, and every level in that course has this switch where you can hit it up to three times per level before it disappears, and what it does is it swaps who has stars are whose.
Oh.
So if your opponent has all the points and you hit the switch, then all of a sudden you have all the points.
Oh.
And so, but there are only three times, so you can switch it back and forth such that if you use it all up, then the person who stole it gets to keep those points.
Oh gosh, that's rough. So, yeah, Kirby's Dream Course is a very interesting game. I wish I was better at it. I'm so bad that I can't really enjoy it the way it's meant to be. But yeah, I was kind of in awe watching TYP play it because he definitely knows what he's doing, and I do not when I try it. So, yeah, I think you covered pretty much everything I wanted to talk about with all the skiing and everything, and finishing up Assassin's Creed 2, which doesn't really bear mentioning here. I didn't really play anything that I didn't play with you this week, so I kind of started Prototype, which I've had from Gamefly for nearly 2 weeks without touching it. Just my backlog right now is pretty bad, and I threw it in there, and I will say, like, for the first 30 minutes of that I played of it, I was kind of surprised because I had this mental image or this expectation of Prototype that it was more like Hulk, where you're kind of this big, bulky character, and I don't know, there was something about my image of the way it played. I'd heard that it was really melee focused and stuff like that, and I just kind of wasn't really looking forward to it that much because of the seeming sluggishness of it or whatever. And I popped it in there, and immediately I was like, oh damn, I mean, this guy moves really fast. He looks like, you know, most of the time he just looks like a normal guy, but he's running up the sides of buildings at blistering speed. He can jump like Spider-Man. And actually the game flows a lot better than I expected. In some ways it flows a lot better than Infamous, which is a game I actually bought last year and, you know, is often compared with Prototype. So, I don't know how much I'm really going to get into it just because I've got so many other games I want to play right now, but it is, like, my first impression of it was actually very good, and it just made me, it's just one of those moments where I'm like, why did I ever doubt this developer? Because they did make that Hulk game for GameCube that is so fucking good, and I loved it so much, and you know, the rumor at one point was that Prototype would be canceled and that Activision was probably going to turn it into a Spider-Man game, and when you play it, you can see how that might actually have worked. And, you know, supposedly the Activision does have a Spider-Man game coming out this year, and maybe it's too soon after Prototype, but I would love for this developer to get their hands on Spider-Man and do something good with it, because that series has been really bad the past few years. And I think these guys could actually totally blow away a Spider-Man game.
Did you guys play that DS game that was basically a mindless brawler? Or was that multiple Spider-Man DS games?
Which one? Yeah.
The overhead one that I had to review.
Overhead? If you're going to play a Spider-Man game on DS, get Web of Shadows. That's good.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Okay, that's not Web of Shadows.
The rest of them are
definitely not.
No, it wasn't.
Not at all.
So, and the console games have been crappy, too.
Still working on No More Heroes 2, are you, Jolly?
Yeah, I mean, still not working on it, I think you mean. But it's coming. Like I said, Tatsunoko's been in the slot for a while, and you know, I'm going to come back to it at some point, but I think for right now, my honeymoon with it is probably pretty much over, and it's just, let's get it out of there and put something else in that I'm actually going to play frequently. So yeah, it's going to happen. By next week, I'll be talking about No More Heroes 2. Don't worry, it'll happen. All right, James.
Yes.
Finishing old games and starting new ones, right?
Yeah, finished off two RPGs this week, bringing it to, like, what, four in the last month and a half?
Yeah.
Which is just staggering if you think about it.
Quite accomplishment.
Yeah.
Last Remnant's done. Glory of Heracles is more or less done. And I haven't talked about that game in a while, so I'll give it really brief.
You mean you're done with it, right?
Effectively. But yeah. I am pretty close to the end of the game. Yeah. So I might go back and finish it sometime when I don't have anything else to play. But that game has no business being probably about 20 hours long. Glory of Heracles, there's no reason for it. It's not as boring as I originally made it out to be. It got less boring, but it's still pretty dull.
Yeah.
I think I was calling it the boring of Heracles for a while.
Right.
The problem with that game comes from the fact that it doesn't really do anything all that creative. And the one thing it's creative about, which would be in its combat system, where you basically have to manage not just kind of the magic points, but each individual element has its own mana system. And that doesn't recharge by resting or anything. It recharges a little bit each turn in battle. And that's really annoying, because when you run out, you take damage. So the only unique mechanic it has isn't good. Which is which is not good, considering three of the RPGs I just played had, you know, unique battle systems that didn't come from the SNES. Yeah, it's just like, I'll spend turns in battles against really weak enemies just sitting there absorbing the little bit of damage they do to basically refill my character's magic points, as well as the whole magic point elemental thing going on up top. I'll just sit there, take a little bit of damage, and heal over and over again so I can build that back up and go into the next fight.
That's terrible. It's like grinding for getting your health back.
Yeah. It's such...
I can think of a few games where I've had to grind to get health back, including the original Blaster Master.
Really?
Yeah,
true. Well, yeah, I could see that Metroid style.
The original Metroid, you have to grind for health sometimes. Yeah.
You have to grind for health when you first start the game.
Yeah, pretty much.
You can only give him like 30 health units. It's absurd.
That's right.
Yeah, it's... I'll call the game decent, but in no way spectacular or memorable.
Well, it didn't crack the top 20 in the NPD for January, which is when it was released.
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a failed product introduction on Nintendo.
Not that many of the DS games that do that aren't the staple ones.
No.
I understand, but, you know, they're trying to introduce a new IP, and I don't know, it doesn't say, you know, Layton did pretty well when they launched
Layton
that.
Layton did, yeah.
But Layton's such a better game.
And Layton also had a sort of rebirth at retail.
Right. And good games sometimes do that.
It's average. It is right down the line average, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and that's not what anybody wants, really. Especially from a 20-hour RPG. I mean, after 20 hours, I got bored of Mario and Luigi Bowser's Inside Story, and that's an excellent game. It's just, I've had enough.
Yeah,
let's wrap
it
up.
I got a little bored with it at the very end. It seemed to drag on at the very end a little bit.
It takes a lot for a DS game to be good through 20, 30 hours.
Yeah,
that's not a fair statement. It takes a lot for any game to be good.
Yeah.
Well, I think on a handheld game, it's harder, though, because it's easier to just put a handheld game down. Because you literally are putting it down. You're just like,
yeah, but you can bring it anywhere. I mean, I don't see the argument.
So, James, what else have you been playing?
I started the Miles Edgeworth what do they call it? Ace Investigator?
Ace Attorney Investigations, Miles Edgeworth, isn't it?
Yeah.
My copy's in the mail.
Yeah. I've only gotten through the first stage, so it's not probably a good representation of what the game is. But near as I can tell, you know, the game is third person now, as opposed to just being a picture that you can kind of poke around on. And I'm not sure this was a great idea.
Use the D-pad.
Yeah, I used to use the D-pad, but and I'm not sure that they really gained anything by doing that.
Well, does it play a little bit more like, say, Gold Rush for the PC now?
Maybe a little. That might not be a bad way of putting it.
Without the DOS prompt, like, textual commands,
yeah, without
right?
that. Because the first, I mean, the first investigation has really, really confined spaces. So, basically, you're either in this one room or you're in a hallway, and it tells you when you need to change rooms because it does it for you. But if the investigations get more expansive, that could, I feel like this could get kind of irksome.
Mm. Well, it's probably too early to tell if the tutorial is holding your hand.
It's
that
been
much.
Getting really good reviews. I'm thinking about picking it up pretty soon because I haven't had a DS game in a while.
I did enjoy it so far. I do like what they did to alleviate the boredom and tedium of the investigation phase of the previous Ace Attorney games, which is basically usually just poke, poke, poke,
right.
poke until
and then
you find
run
something.
Into a wall and they're like, now what do I do? Right?
Yeah, until you find something that you can poke that gives you an affirmative response,
right.
Much like life. Whereas in this game, they kind of intersperse the interactive, not quite full trials that kind of come up in place of just the whole investigation process. They kind of happen in the middle of it.
They sort of had that in the second and third one too.
Yeah,
with those psych locks.
The psych locks, but it's more integrated this time,
oh,
as
good.
Opposed to. Oh, you have a psych lock. I'll be back in 3 to 4 hours.
it was a good game.
Yeah, it's more like you find something and then somebody in the background makes a comment and then Edgeworth has his internal monologue and then you get to play logic games.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that in the demo.
But they have the courtroom scenes too, right?
I haven't seen any yet. The whole first case doesn't have a single courtroom scene in it, but you do cross-examine a witness in the middle of the investigation.
That's weird. Yeah, I was kind of wondering. I think from the couple of reviews I read, it wasn't really clear whether the court scenes are still in it. And I would hope so, because to me that would be, you know, one of the most interesting things is playing through the same kinds of cases that you did with Phoenix Wright, but now you're on the other side of the coin.
Right.
It may be that the gameplay is similar, but you're getting very different reactions from the characters, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the game's going to be more leveraged on the investigatory process, because I don't think we ever... Well, we did name a suspect in the first level, but it wasn't really, like... It's more half-hearted than anything. Like, yeah, they must have done it. and you immediately knew they didn't do it. You're like, well, that's not the case. Let's go. But I'm not sure that they could really work the game as I'm going to convict this guy, because I mean, it kind of makes it hard to empathize with any of the characters. If you know the guy there is guilty and you're not trying to save somebody, it kind of makes you an anti-hero character, so I'm not sure how well it would work.
It's an interesting idea. I mean, there's certainly slimy people and slimy lawyers out there and stuff. I'm hurting people's feelings. They're not all slimy folks, just some of them. And you can edit all this out, right, Greg?
I can. Yeah, it is within my power to do so.
Right. Whether or not that occurs.
But what I was trying to say is that, like, they wouldn't necessarily have to go with, like, murder cases or anything for this if they wanted to avoid something like that.
It seems like they usually do, though.
Yeah, they're always murder cases. It's like it is not safe to be an acquaintance of someone who knows Phoenix Wright, because you will die.
Right. It's kind of like in Assassin's Creed, like you meet a character who actually has a first and last name, that bitch going die.
Dead.
Pretty much.
Like, it's pretty much telegraphed.
It's like, yeah,
he might seem friendly now, but he's got a last name, so you know what's about to happen.
this surname's the new red shirt. That's
yeah, exactly.
Pretty much.
Let's go on an away team mission.
you
later.
I mean, I got to the first case in about an hour or two. I really enjoyed it. I'm curious if it's going to be just long investigation strings now, as opposed to the courtroom series that kind of punctuated it. I do think it's probably going to be more or less predictable format than the previous games, and that's probably good for the franchise right
now. Even the first Phoenix Wright, that's the only one I've played, but even that one actually got kind of unpredictable at times. I mean, there's the one mission where maybe this is a spoiler for people who are playing it on WiiWare now for the first time, but there's a case where Phoenix has been accused of something. He actually has to defend himself, basically.
Yeah.
It does play, even, you know, the first game in the series, they play with the formula a little bit by the end, so I always like that about those games.
I'm curious if they're going to actually make more of these Miles Edgeworth games, though, or if they're just done with the Phoenix Wright franchise.
Well, is the team working on Ghost Trick next?
I don't know if that's the same team, is it?
Is it really the same?
I think it is. I think it's the same people, or at least some of them. But then again, it's not as if you couldn't get someone else to do something, or, you know, if that doesn't preclude anything, I'm sure long as it's successful, they'll keep going to the
Ace Attorney
stuff.
Well,
they do
seem to turn these games out pretty fast.
Yeah, this is Capcom, guys. Yeah. This is going to be another Ace Attorney game.
Yeah, you're right. It's Shu Takumi's game. I assume his team is working on it.
No, then that looks really quite interesting.
It does. I had actually forgotten about that game. I'm glad you reminded me of it.
It was only shown at TGS. So.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's got to be relatively close to completion.
Yeah, probably. Well, I guess it's time to move on. Greg, I know you haven't had much time to play this week.
Yeah, my new business was primarily last week's podcast.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was busy. The longest episode I've ever edited. I think it's probably the longest episode that any single person has ever edited, because the overall title belongs to 100, which was edited by James and Carl.
Yeah, I did 2 hours and Carl did an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, 2 hours and 35 minutes of goodness.
Yeah.
if you throw in recording, all the file processing and the actual editing and adding the music to the Games of the Decade nominees, and the feeds and the chapter art and all that, probably took close to 24 hours to do.
Greg pretty much plays an RPG named Audacity every weekend.
It's true. I spend far more time.
I play it too, but not as well.
Almost every week, I spend more time editing the podcast than I do playing games, which is a little perverse. But yeah. This week, I didn't have a lot to do. I finished off Big Bang Mini on my train rides, which that was good. Unlocked some other modes and stuff, so I'll probably come back to it here and there. They had on PSN a sale for the first anniversary of Flower, which TYP brought up earlier. It basically got its price slashed by nearly two-thirds.
Whoa,
so
wow.
it was down to a couple of quid, basically. And I thought, well, for that price, why not? Let's have a look at this.
Someone actually sent me a pro tip that Flow, which is by the same developer, it was the precursor to Flower, sort of, was actually available for free, celebrating probably the same anniversary. And I said, well, by the time I got the message, it was too late for me to get it. But I said, actually, I played it back when it was a PC Flash game and it was free anyway. So, I appreciate the tip, but I'm not going to lose too much sleep.
Yeah, I think I caught that one. I'm not sure whether that ever happened in Europe or not, because it was all over by the time I would have seen it.
You can probably still play Flow for free online, I would
guess. Oh, yeah, it's still out there.
It's a neat game. It's nothing compared to Flower, though.
So a couple of quid. Yeah, I've heard some good things about Flower. Let's try it. And of course, the thing is with the PSN, it doesn't have its own currency.
Yeah.
But it does place limits on, like, you have to fund a minimum amount to your sort of wallet on your account. And what Flower was so cheap that it didn't meet this, so I actually put extra money in. And then I thought, oh, bugger it, I may as well finally get Bionic Commando Rearmed if I put an extra money in. So I haven't played that at all yet, I haven't had time, but I will be, because I picked something I knew I would purchase one day anyway. It was inevitable. I accepted the fact that, yes, their policy was getting me to buy something else, but it wasn't going to be something additional, it was just going to be something slightly sooner.
Right.
So I stood my ground there.
Well done.
But Flower, yeah, it's, I think the imagery is definitely quite arresting. You know, I knew exactly what it was going to look like because I've seen videos and I've heard about it, but it still had an effect. You know, when you see it, it's very striking. And the first few stages are sort of what you imagine it would be like, just kind of blowing around into these flowers and through the grass and all that, and it's very pretty. But just the last couple of bits that I've played, it goes into slightly different territory, into sort of nighttime, and then this monochrome kind of dark, dilapidated landscape,
right,
where you've actually got obstacles and stuff. And that, I enjoyed that, because even though it's not quite as serene and everything, It's just the fact that it wasn't a visual one-trick pony kind of was important to me. That he had a little bit of a sense of a journey, a little bit of a sense of going different places. And it does. It's funny how it changes how you feel about what you're doing, even though what you're doing is not that different, obviously, because it's quite a straightforward game.
Right.
But I mean, the motion controls are fine. It seems appropriate for that kind of game where it's not terribly precise, but it's certainly effective enough. You don't feel like you're handicapped.
The character on screen isn't terribly precise either.
No,
so
it's an amorphous sort of thing. Exactly. No, it fits. And yeah, there's lots of nice little touches. I like when you slow down and it goes into slow motion.
Yeah.
The sound design that goes into that as well, and the sort of musical element, as you kind of want to not miss any of the little flowers as you blow past them, because it would kind of interrupt the kind of musical sequence that's going on, because they each emit a note or some other, sometimes like a choral kind of bit.
There's almost an electroplankton element to it.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to what I imagine electroplankton to be. I've never played it. But for this price, you really can't argue. I mean, at its full price, which is about £6.30 or something, full price of PSN, it's competing a bit closer with stuff like Braid and Bionic Commando, and I don't know. It's so radically different. I mean, they're really quite incommensurable as it is.
Yeah, but it's to the point where you're probably not going to make an impulse purchase on it. You know, $10 in the U.S. at least it's like, well, I kind of would like to know that I'm going to enjoy this if I'm going to drop that much on it.
Because, I mean, it's the kind of thing that you don't know whether you want it or not, because it's kind of weird and you haven't necessarily played.
And there's
stuff
no
like
demo
it
for it. There really should be.
So you're in that situation where there's stuff that's similarly priced that you know you want to play, that they're going to win. Mm-hmm. But at this price, I went with it. A similar sort of thing, I did play the Heavy Rain demo, which I have no intention of buying for full price, because, as people know, I've not paid anywhere near full price for anything on PS3.
including Flower.
I'm not going to... Yeah, included Flower. But not Bionic Commando. Damn, I've broken the string.
But that game's underpriced to begin with. It always has been.
I'm really looking forward to that. But with the Heavy Rain thing, it's just like... It's really intriguing to me, but again, I don't know that I want that. And I mean, the demo reinforced that, because it's quite a curious thing, really, you know, because you've got this... It seems like it's set up for point-and-click style kind of interface, the way you're interacting with the environment. I don't know whether that was ever on the table with the PS3 motion controller, but they eventually kind of didn't want to get on that timeline and just kind of settled for something around the controller.
I kind of doubt it, because Heavy Rain's been in development for a long
time. A long time, I know.
Yes.
So that I kind of doubt it, but it seems like it would be really well suited to it, because a lot of what you're doing is kind of similar to what James said. You're poking stuff, basically.
Pretty much.
You know, you're walking around and you're looking at different bits of the environment. You know, it's like an incredibly sort of gritty crime scene. It's all very kind of organic. But ultimately, you know, you put on this like scan visor shades and then start poking everything, essentially, metaphorically speaking, for little forensic clues like footprint trails, blood samples, and petal traces and all sorts of things. So, I mean, that's the sort of the part, the little chunk of it I played. But obviously, I mean, the main thing about it is the narrative and stuff. And it was just interesting to see how it is, the gameplay kind of element. I'm sure there's more to it than just that as well. And then, of course, there's weird stuff. So much of it is just indirect control. And then on the other hand, you have to, like, button mash to run up a slippy hill. Because of the quick timey bit.
A slippy hill? Are we talking about, like, Star Fox 64 here?
No, it's not slippery slope.
Oh, okay. It's slippery slope.
As the title implies, there is precipitation occurring in the game, and this makes muddy banks slippy, and you have to get up them. And if you want to get up them, you have to press the buttons on the DualShock in the correct combinations to do so. So,
yeah.
To me, I don't think it's a game that's ever going to demo that well, because it's supposed to be so kind of cinematic and stuff. I'm guessing, you know, it's all got to be in the right context and stuff. So, but I was still interested to see just how weird the interface is. It is probably as weird as advertised.
Well, I'll be playing the demo myself soon. So that's going to be new business for this week. Like I said, John will have his when he gets back next time. So now we're going to take a break. When we come back, Super Mario RPG.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, this week on NintendoWorldReport.com, Zach Miller blogged with a thrilling photo essay on the unboxing of his Wii Remote holder, that little white plastic unfolding box from Club Nintendo. Yes.
Awesome.
And Neil also sings the praises of Q Games with their DSiWare releases in his own blog.
Matt Blunden's been busy with DSiWare as well, pumping out reviews of Number Battle, Spotto, and Lincoln Launch. He also took some time to review Super Monkey Ball Step and Roll, which he thought was okay, but frustrating due to the imprecision of the balance board controls.
I do like that they just named exactly what you do in the game, Step and Roll.
Step and Roll!
The first Super Monkey Ball might have been nominated for Game of the Decade if it hadn't been for some of its sequels.
Yeah,
no, don't say that.
Sorry.
That's terrible.
Sorry.
So we have all the Ace Attorney investigations of Miles Edgeworth that you could ever possibly want. Neil reviewed it and makes the claim that it may be the best entry in the franchise yet. And we have an interview with Motohide Eshiro, the producer of the Ace Attorney's investigates Miles Edgeworth. And he gives us...
Investigations Miles Edgeworth.
Yes. And he gives us insight to development and localization, and it talks about they tried to get Phoenix Wright into Tatsunoko versus Capcom.
It's the interview, people.
Anyway, Neil continues his busy week with impressions of Endless Ocean Blue World, which he just received for review. He likes what he sees, and he likes online play and co-op. And it has WeSpeak compatibility.
No, WeSpeak, so it'll sound like you're actually under the water when you talk to somebody.
Very good point. And I'm sure you'll hear more about Neil's thoughts on that game in the next episode of NWR Newscast when they do Whatcha Been Reviewing. Okay, so that's what's going on the website this week. Please check it out. You'll support the website and this very podcast. Alright, we are back, and before we jump into Retroactive, I do want to take a couple of minutes here for at least one listener mail. We didn't have time to get to it last week because of the crazy Game of the Decade discussion, and this week we're a little tight as well because of Retroactive. I promise we're going to catch up on listener mail probably next week, but I wanted to at least get a little taste here and at least chip off the top of our pile of great, great letters that we've been getting recently. So, I think Greg is going to read this one.
Okay, this is from David Becker, and he comes with a shout-out. We haven't had one of these in a while, but mm-hmm. He said, I'd like to give a shout-out to Ninja 5-0 for Game Boy Advance, known as Ninja Cop in Europe. It stars a ninja with a grappling hook, so the recipe for awesomeness is right there from the start.
Yes.
Grappling hooks in games often allow crazy maneuvers that make you feel more awesome than any canned combo Dante or Kratos could produce, and Ninja 5-0 combines that with the smooth flow of being a ninja with a powerful sword, so you can swing towards an enemy, jump slash, and continue seamlessly while the enemy collapses dead behind you. No need for lengthy combos that make you wonder when your character last sharpened that sword. I find that this sense of flow and flawless execution greatly factors into the enjoyment of the game. It feels like you're doing really well. The continue system also helps with that. You need to start the level over if you die, and the game is pretty hard, so you'll often traverse the same environments over and over while working on your progress, and you can really hone your ability to get through them fast and eliminate all enemies along the way. When you finally finish the level, you feel a great sense of satisfaction about it, and that, I think, is missing when you get frequent checkpoints and can beat a section even if you barely manage to scrape past it.
Now, James, you've actually played this, right?
Very briefly, yes. And yeah, that works for me.
Okay.
His description's fine by me. It's been
my
a long
only
time.
Memories of this this game are actually, it's kind of strange. When I was an intern at a video game company that will remain nameless and is now defunct.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I know of this experience, Mike. You have to tell me off air. I'm
all
very
right.
Curious.
Well, anyway, there was one guy who really loved this game, and he would play it on his breaks, and he was really into it. But I didn't get it.
Yeah, seeing that, I've always heard things about this being really great. But it's one of these where I just kind of, I didn't have very many games for my GBA. It's strange. I really didn't, looking back on it, compared to DS, it's nothing. And, I just didn't get around to picking this one up. But
That's appropriate, though. Trust me.
I've looked into it since, and it's difficult to get, and especially with like eBay being rife with counterfeit games that you don't know whether they're even going to work properly and all that. It's a bit of a sticky situation to try and go back and pick it up. But
for sure.
It always sounded really cool. I think it's by Konami.
It's a Hudson Soft developed game.
Right, yeah. It's probably just published by them, because they've got that partnership kind of thing in some of the markets.
Right, yeah.
But it sounds the kind of game I'd like. I think it makes an interesting point about the whole checkpoint issue, because this came up with Sin and Punishment 2, in the sense that sometimes I wonder whether, in some ways, it might have been better off making the game a little bit easier, the checkpoints a little bit spaced out, because there's a kind of a rhythm that's not that great, where you're kind of just bumbling your way through a bunch of frequently sort of broken up segments. And I do like it where you get that perfect balance of, feeling like you accomplished something to get to a checkpoint, but obviously if it's too punitive, then you get frustrated, and it's much more likely that you put the game down and never go back to it.
Right. It's tricky. Yeah, well, Ninja 5-0, I've never played it. I've always wanted to, though, ever since I read Mike Sklenz's review on Nintendo World Report, or Planet GameCube back then. He gave it a 9 out of 10 and had a lot of really nice things to say about it. He compared it to Bionic Commando and Revenge of Shinobi and Ninja Gaiden, and that sounds pretty good to me. I mean, I think you guys know how I feel about grappling hooks. So, I always wanted to play it. And honestly, I've never seen a copy of it. I mean, it's something that if I'd ever seen it, I probably would have just grabbed it. And
I think it has fairly silly box art.
It is. It is an exceptionally silly,
if you had seen it.
It's got a silly name.
If you had seen it, you would have laughed and kept walking.
Exactly. The name and the box art and all that, a bit throwback to NES era.
Yeah, it is.
You know what I mean?
Now, the amazing thing is, it's a Hudson Soft game that's not a shooter. So,
yeah.
Or a bombing game.
Or a bombing game. No.
They are making Bonk again. So
there you go.
Well, thanks, Dave, for the shout out there. And of course, we are happy to take your shout outs. If you have a game that you don't think people really know about and you kind of want to throw it out there, we may not even know about it, but we'll be happy to read your letter, and definitely we'll help put everybody on alert to keep an eye out for those games, and maybe even just bring up some memories for people who did actually play them. So it is now time to jump into Retroactive. Before we do, I do want to mention you can send your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And again, we're going to be catching up on a lot of great letters that we've received in the past few weeks very soon, I think next episode. So I'm looking forward to it, actually. With that said, it's now time for Super Mario RPG. This is our 11th Retroactive game. Not the 11th poll, of course. The first one we selected with Dynamite Heady, just to kickstart it. And then I think with Geist, that was kind of a special case because we had the interview lined up with Jeff Callis. So anyway, this was the second chance poll, Mario RPG. This was one of the runners-up, one of the two. And it beat out ActRaiser and games from two or three other systems to be the new Retroactive game. Not a big surprise.
And it's also, was it the third RPG of some description of the 11 because of Secret Mana and Shining Force 2?
Something like that.
Well, if you count Zelda 2, which is really an RPG,
yes,
it has some RPG elements.
It's a lot closer to RPG than other Zelda games.
It is, yes. Yeah, we might have to do something about that next time, but
yes,
it's tough.
More ill-advised, but I think we got our ducks in a row more this time. So.
Yeah. We kind of let this one marinate for a little bit longer, especially knowing that, all four of us on the regular crew, including John, have all played Super Mario RPG before to some extent, and so we thought, well, it's not as interesting for us to play the first 2 hours and talk about that because everybody's played the first 2 hours of this game, so it'd be better to get deeper into it. And so I guess I want to start the discussion by asking, going around the table here, and of course, TYP, I know you didn't really play along for this because you didn't know you were going to be on the show until recently, but you've certainly played Super Mario RPG before, right?
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah.
Multiple times.
Yeah, I played through it a couple of times.
Yeah. what are some of kind of your thoughts on the stuff that comes later in the game? Do you feel like the game evolves a good bit as it goes? Some of the new elements they get introduced, some of the new characters. I mean, you know, you play a little way into it, almost halfway before you get Bowser and Peach.
Yeah, I'd say that, like, once you get Bowser and Peach, it kind of levels off. There's some interesting stuff later, like the Monstro Town, I think, is very clever, and there's some pretty funny things in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just funny characters, interactions with these baddies gone good. Like, at one point, like, Bowser comes out, and the former Goomba that was under his leadership is now, like, made a family and stuff. And so there's some interesting stuff there.
Yeah.
But it kind of peters out. I mean, I guess there's some interesting stuff in the Sky area. I didn't get a chance to play that. I picked up a save file that was a little bit before Monster Town and played through that.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, I mean, it's weird. The whole game is a lot more straightforward than other RPGs that I've played.
Very, you know, linear. In
terms of, well, yeah, I mean, it's quite guided and everything. I mean, there are side quests and stuff, but you certainly get channeled down, you know, the main road of it. And also, just in terms of the plot, it's relatively straightforward. You know, it's very much like, okay, you know, you've got the 7 stars, which kind of mark how close you are getting towards the end.
Right.
And it's like, you know, there's a villain at the start, there's a sort of dilemma at the start, and, you know, you pretty much just end up resolving that. You know, it's not like most RPGs where it's like, oh, this is what you're aiming to do, and then something completely changes and turns out there's a way bigger villain. There's a sort of nested doll progression of villainy or something.
That happens within the first 5 minutes of the game.
Well, the only real twist is that Bowser joins your party. Because from the beginning, you wouldn't really expect that. I mean, you do fight him at the end of the prologue.
Yeah, that's true. If I had that, it ruthlessly spoiled for me back in 1996 by English magazines.
Right,
I wouldn't have expected that.
Right.
Which, of course, as I've mentioned before, this is a game that I owned in 1996 but didn't play. Because for those people that still have the cartridge, you may notice that it has actually 3 connectors on the bottom of it. It was a very rare Super NES game that actually made use of the 3 connectors. That there are for Super NES games, and this meant that it didn't work with my Japanese to American converter.
Ooh.
So I couldn't play it. I bought it, couldn't play it, and then the import store was very kindly accepted it back. And so I then didn't play it for 12 years until it came out on virtual console.
Yeah.
And I often wonder how things would have been different, how much more I might have got into RPGs had I played it.
Well, it was never released in Europe until virtual console.
It was never released in Europe, but then I didn't buy games from Europe, so it didn't really affect me.
Irrelevant.
But that was, I ended up, the first turn-based, I had Secret of Mana, which of course we talked about before, the first turn-based RPG I ever played was Chrono Trigger a few years after it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, we were on to the N64, there wasn't really kind of a viable scene for RPG, so that didn't really lead to anything. Because reading the forum threads and stuff, people talk about it, you know, being a game that kind of, you know, helped get them into RPGs and stuff like that. I kind of wonder about that for myself. But going back to 2008 when it came out on the virtual console, I mean, I liked the fact that it was quite brisk. You know, I mean, I guess you kind of feel like you're making progress quite a lot of the time. You don't feel like you're spinning your wheels.
The pacing's quite good, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you jump into it pretty fast, and then it never really bogs down. A lot of RPGs do. You know, a lot of RPGs get to
I think probably because they feel like they have to compete with other RPGs that are also long, or they, you know, they have to give you, like, more or whatever. They feel under pressure. I think because this was somewhat unconventional, and because obviously, you know, it was whimsical and things like that, they made, you know, good choices to say, you know, let's not try and make it something it isn't.
That's definitely something that Mario and Luigi series kind of carry the torch on, too.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, a lot of people like to compare this game to Paper Mario and Mario and Luigi, but it's interesting when Greg mentioned Chrono Trigger a minute ago. I think you could actually draw a lot of comparisons between Super Mario RPG and Chrono Trigger. For one thing, they were released very close to each other. They were developed,
within a year.
Probably some overlap even in their development schedules. But if you think about the way that the battles tend to go very fast, the way that you see enemies on the overworld before you...
And can avoid them.
Right, you can sort of avoid them a lot of the time. The very simple equipment systems and things like that. I mean, you know, both games are, by Square's 16-bit standards, pretty simple. and they make it work for them. You know, they're not overly simple. They're just kind of stripped down.
I mean, both cases where Square are collaborating with outside kind of influences, where obviously it was the Dragon Quest kind of influence on Chrono Trigger, and then and obviously the Nintendo influence in this case. But I mean, I think there's a lot of good things about the way it works. Obviously, first of all, there's the timing aspect, which I think is definitely a good way of not making it just a procession of pressing a button indiscriminately, like certain RPGs.
I agree, but I find that the big difference between Chrono Trigger and Mario RPG that plays into this timing thing is the difference in animation. I think really where Mario RPG falls flat on its face these days by modern standards is its animation is pretty crude.
Probably because of the pre-rendered
I understand style. That, yeah. But it's like, you know, when Mario is punching someone but it doesn't connecting with the actual person he's punching with.
Yes.
Punching. That's really weird. And the timing, it's like, I don't know when I'm supposed to push A. I mean, I've learned over years when to push A, but...
This is something that comes into, that I find applies to a lot of games, but certainly with Super Mario RPG, my timing is based by sound, not sight.
Yeah.
Every time there's an attack that has a particular sort of, you know, sequence of noises to accompany it, and that's how I base my timing.
Well, I mean... TYP, you say that's weird. It may just be because you didn't play many RPGs before this, but at the time, up until Chrono Trigger, really, the norm was for, you know, in battle scenes, your character would kind of swing a sword, and then across the screen, the enemy would take damage. Final Fantasy 4 and 5 and 6 are all like that.
Yeah, in fact, even some early ones, they had a grid, and there was a line down the middle and said,
right,
they're on this side of the screen, they're on this side of the screen.
And then in Dragon Quest, you never even see your characters in battle. So
I've played plenty of RPGs that do that, where it's Mario RPG somewhere in between, and that's what sort of irks me almost.
Right.
It's like, it's
they get close, but they aren't actually connecting, and that's just sort of weird to me. I don't know, it's a little bit of both, and also it's just stiff.
Compared to Chrono Trigger, like with Chrono Trigger, like distance and proximity kind of matters.
Yeah.
In
sometimes.
Certain cases, which is a slightly different way of kind of making it feel more physical. Here it's with the timing of the button presses, which, again, the one thing I'd say is that in something like Paper Mario, the timing felt so forgiving as it was almost trivial.
Right.
Whereas, I don't know, you can go back and forth on whether you think it's kind of annoying that the timing, you will sometimes miss it, or whether it's good because it makes it more meaningful. But that for me, it never felt as inevitable that I was going to time it correctly with all these different moves in Super Mario RPG as it did in the subsequent games.
Yeah, there is some skill to it. James, what are your thoughts on kind of the stuff in the later half of the game?
I was never a really big fan of this game. I always felt like, because I came in later to the game after people had already hyped it a lot, I always felt like it was kind of an overhyped title. I don't feel like it really progresses that much further once you get, you know, Bowser involved in the game as a party member. It just kind of...
I mean, there's some cool special attacks that you get, kind of interesting, but yeah, I mean, gameplay-wise...
It's still the same game.
I barely used the special attacks personally. I think
I think they're interesting from the point of view that they can look funny, like it's a Mecha Koopa or like, you know, Geno turns into a cannon, but I don't know that gameplay-wise, there's some great revelation sort of improve your tactical kind of thing. I mean, I guess that's the thing, like, compared to, again, something like Chrono Trigger, I've kind of felt like the development of the double and triple text was more interesting later in the game than the stuff that happens with the Mario characters.
Yeah,
I just felt like the game has a distinct lack of evolution that I was kind of accustomed to. But the thing is, because
of its relative brevity, you don't feel that too sorely. You know, it's a kind of pretty merry sort of jaunt through it. I never really felt like it was getting bogged down. So, I mean, I think it's a fair point, but it's not an Achilles heel.
So I have a counterpoint to, you know, the argument that the game does kind of level off, and that's that one of my favorite parts of the game, it didn't come up too much in the forum thread, but I love how the different characters have different weapons. I mean, each character probably has three, maybe four different classes of weapons. And maybe you'll get a couple of palette swaps or maybe even identical looking versions of them that just have different stats. But, you know, Mario... Yeah. In combat, it feels a lot different when he's punching as opposed to when he's using a hammer, as opposed to when he's drop-kicking a Koopa shell. And all the characters have that, and it's actually really cool when you go into a shop and you see that there's a new weapon over there, and you're like, I don't even know which character that goes to. You know, you have to actually look, because it's like a frying pan. Who would use a frying pan?
And then there's one where, like, there's gloves, and I was like, oh, that's got to be Mario, but it's actually Bowser's, because he throws Mario at him, and he's with the gloves.
That's actually my favorite attack, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I like a lot is that sometimes you get new weapons because of story elements, or at least that you did something, you know, in adventuring, not just that you went into a shop or that you found a treasure chest somewhere. So like in Booster's Tower, I really love the scene where you go in and rescue the Chain Chomp, and that becomes Bowser's new weapon. That's an awesome weapon.
Using that as a Morning Star, Chain Chomp.
It's fantastic. I mean, it looks cool, it's fun to use, and the way that you get it is very memorable. You know, it's totally different than going into a shop and buying something off a menu. And that actually happens in a couple cases. In that same dungeon, Mario launches onto a seesaw catapult and gets a hammer out. It's a little bit less momentous than the Chain Chomp one, but it's still a really cool way to get a new weapon. And, you know, the weapon is worth it. Like, it seems like they actually married the importance of getting this new weapon to actually having you solve a puzzle that makes it feel worthwhile. And a lot of these things are optional, but they're totally worth doing.
I mean it's kind of a bit between the kind of pure presentational, like with some of the special attacks, and then kind of a bit more gameplay based, isn't it? You know, it feels more significant, I think. But it is part of the cool kind of packaging. It feels less authentic as a kind of Mario package than something like Mario & Luigi, the Mario & Luigi games.
Well, it
come
is.
Later.
I mean...
Because they really nail it. It's so all-encompassing and it's so carefully referenced. Whereas this is kind of a weird mix of elements at times. I mean, there's lots of great Mario fan service. I can think of bits like, well, there's in Booster's Tower, for instance, there's a bit where there's like a changing room.
Yeah.
And if you go through it, he comes out as 8-bit Mario. Or like there's a part where they try throwing a barrel at him in the pirate ship, which of course he jumps over straight away because he's an expert at that. And they're like, how dare you jump over the barrel? So there's loads of, there is a lot of that nice kind of stuff, but at the same time, it's not quite all the way there. Like just the fact that you've got a lot of these characters that are just like, who are they? And where they felt like they could have put in maybe some characters from the Mario kind of mythos.
Yeah, why do you have Booster instead of Wario?
He looks a lot like Wario.
Hard to say. It may have just been that at the time, Wario wasn't really that well known or that important of a character within Nintendo.
I guess not. And then it's the absence of Luigi as well. Just seems
that always bothered me, because they always are talking about, oh, Mario, you're such a good jumper. You must be Mario. Oh, wow, you're the best jumper in Mushroom Kingdom. Like, guys?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they barely even gave lip service to Luigi, even in Paper Mario.
But they did do something. Well, it was like, oh, he's staying at home. Like,
yeah, he was at home
joke.
Writing these furtive journal entries to himself about how he's been left behind.
Actually kind of funny.
They kind of made a joke out of the fact they were burying him.
The point, there's only one reference to Luigi that I've found in the entire game, and that's like, I wish I could be more like my brother is a wish.
That's on the dreams part, the wishes, yeah.
So I felt pretty cheated.
I always kind of felt like that game almost just kind of pasted the Mario stuff over an existing game in some ways.
Yeah.
Like, some stuff just doesn't make sense.
Some of the attacks are just, like, really generic, like, you know, drain or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, there is some of that. But I also feel, while it might not be up to, like, Mario & Luigi standards, there's plenty of nice weaving with the Mario kind of mythos in there.
Well, this was the first attempt at it, and so it's not completely fair to compare this game with Mario & Luigi.
This is a really good time to bring in a forum comment on, for a couple of different reasons. So this is from Jet Pilot, who sort of agrees with James that the game's overrated, although I think he likes it far less than you do, James. quote, Super Mario RPG is a pile of trash. The story of Super Mario RPG is uninteresting tripe. The presentation is very slow and extremely boring. I often found myself wanting to turn off the game out of sheer boredom. I only made it several hours into it because the tedium of the game was just too much for me to handle. The game's controls are unresponsive, and the camera point of view was not a good choice for the elements included. The character progression is, at best, monotonous and tiresome. The visuals in Super Mario RPG have that horrible 16-bit plasticky look. The only thing decent about this game is the music. In my opinion, Square knew that they had a lousy RPG, so they slapped Mario's face in the game in order to disguise the fact that without the Mario skin, this title would otherwise be considered a complete pile of garbage by the masses.
All right, I laughed because when I said that it almost felt like they pasted Mario on top of it, what I was really thinking and I was self-censoring was Square had a B-team RPG and they said, how can we make this game sell?
Right. I think that's unlikely. And even if it is true, the game would have had to have been pretty early on because there's so many Mario elements. And it's not just characters or location. I mean, there aren't even that many familiar locations.
No, no.
But the way that you play the game,
the
jumping around, you know, the platformy exploration of the entire game, the combat system,
yeah,
is all pretty distinctly Mario. You know, I mean, sometimes it's things that Mario had never done before, but there are also things that probably wouldn't make sense with any other character or brand being applied to it. So I think Square, you know, and it's a bit maybe like the Kingdom Hearts situation, which is where Square teamed up with Disney and made something that's not really like Disney, you know, like there's a lot of weird stuff in it that's not from Disney at all. And I think even more so in Super Mario RPG, I think it was Square trying to assert its equality with Nintendo in making this game. And I feel like they probably wanted to create a lot of original elements to be combined with that. And really, if you think about the Geno example, which everybody brings up, man, Geno was such a cool character. I wish he would come back. I mean, in a lot of ways, they succeeded. You know, people talk about liking boosters so much. People talk about the humor and the pantomiming. I mean, none of this really was in Mario before that. I think most of that came from Square. So I think they were very successful in combining a lot of their input and their ideas and even some of their original characters with all of this extremely familiar Mario stuff. And I think the game is better for it. And I think actually one thing that's missing a little bit in Paper Mario especially is that Paper Mario is so strictly straightforward Mario stuff,
yeah,
that it actually comes across as a bit boring to me just in terms of style. And I think what's great about Mario and Luigi is that Alpha Dream went back to the Square model where they're like, well, we're going to use a lot of Mario stuff, but we're going to create our own characters like Fawful and just really get crazy with it. And you're going to see things, you're going to see elements in this that you've never seen a Mario game before. And that's okay. We're not afraid to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you want a mix, definitely, to keep it fresh in that sense. But I think there's some notable kind of achievements that they had in this, apart from the timing and stuff, that I think was a good idea for maybe, you know, having a more streamlined RPG, whereas before, obviously, the direction of travel other than Chrono Trigger was kind of getting more complicated. Like, the menu system, I really like the separation between the four buttons.
Yeah,
that's
the face buttons, that's really good. The only downfall is that when you go to like items, that they're not just sort of collapsed down. So if you've got like, I don't know, 14 mushrooms or something, it's not
yes,
just mushrooms times 14 rather than
it's mushroom.
Yeah, that's silly. You've streamlined it so nicely, why would you clutter it at the end like that?
It doesn't make any sense because they've been doing that for ages.
In fact, the funny thing about it is that it's so instant, it kind of almost seems like it'd be perfect to be paired up with an active time battle system, which it doesn't have.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny that it doesn't have that, because it's not like Square hadn't implemented an active time
battle system at that point. They had
implemented it all over the place. They were dropping it on everything.
I think Square probably thought active time battle was too advanced for the audience they were going for. I mean, it does make the game more difficult. And even in Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6, you can turn it off if you find that it makes the battle
if you're
too
lame
difficult.
I generally turn it off, to be quite frank.
Yeah.
I mean, well, then I need to retract my previous statement then. Greg, please edit that out.
Some people like to play their RPGs very leisurely. Sometimes you're in the middle of a battle and you just want to kind of get up and walk away for a minute. And you know, I can definitely appreciate the feeling that you get out of that, in that, you know, I mean, Chrono Trigger is very active time battle. I don't even know if you can turn it off in that game.
You can.
Okay, you can.
Yeah,
but,
you can.
But, you know, you leave active time battle on, and those battles feel pretty intense a lot of times. I mean, you feel like you need to hurry up and put your commands in. And, yeah, I mean, Greg has a nice point, because with the menu system laid out during combat in Mario, you can actually make your decisions very quickly, which is nice. It cuts down on a lot of downtime that's just...
I wouldn't say that, you know, that this game screams for active type battle in itself, but it's funny that I've not seen, like, in any, like, you know, DS RPG or anything like that, marriage of, like, this really clear, streamlined menu kind of interface with an active type battle system. I think that would be quite interesting.
Right.
But they also make cool use of it in one of the boss fights where, like, they literally have it explicitly, like, okay, right, he's going to disable one of your buttons and then you won't be able to do something.
Right, that's
and
cool.
Things like that. I mean, that is some really cool ideas.
Yeah. I think the closest thing I can remember to that control layout for an RPG would be, I think, in the game Paladin's Quest, which is a Super Nintendo game I've mentioned before. It's a very unusual game from Enix, and it's worth tracking down if you ever see a copy of it. I'd say pick it up. It's really cool. But I seem to recall in that game you can control the entire battle with only the D-pad, so you don't actually even have to use a button. And that was back in the day when a lot of people were really enamored with this idea of playing an RPG with one hand, because you could use the other hand for maps or for holding open a strategy guide or something like that, or eating a sandwich, which is probably, you know, something you might have. Well, because of the pacing of the game, it seems a bit silly to have both of your hands wrapped around this complex controller.
Delicious.
It's like just unnecessary. It's kind of, you know, similar to the idea of the Wii Remote, in that you can play a lot of Wii games with one hand, and it just feels more relaxed to do it that way.
I always felt like that a Mario game, even a Mario RPG, needs something that's more active, though.
Mm-hmm. And it is.
Like, more active than a turn-based battle system. It just never made sense to me. Mm. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think the timing thing was a pretty big deal. I mean, I think you give them that. But, I mean, some of the platforming aspect's really interesting in terms of, you know, it has got some, but it's doing it from this isometric perspective, which is what Jet Pilot brought up.
Yes,
in the
and he's part. Right about that. It is a bad perspective.
It's a curious choice to me. That, you know, but look at what they do in Mario and Luigi, the Mario and Luigi games. You know, the platforming works fine with a three-quarter view sort of overhead, doesn't it? So it's weird that they went isometric. I mean, because one of the things with isometric is, even if you kind of do it as well as you can do it, and I think they did it relatively well, considering, you know,
well,
everything.
If you've ever played Landstalker, you know how bad it could be.
I can certainly recall you remarking about that. But, I mean, with this, it's always kind of awkward, just from the very fact that it's like, to kind of go straight, you're always pressing diagonals.
It's actually easier with a joystick on a classic controller.
Yeah, that's not a bad point. I mean, I was going to say, the good thing is the D-pad on the Super NES was pretty good. I mean, if you go with a PlayStation pad, you might really have some problems.
Yes. the isometric thing is weird because Square had not really made any other isometric RPGs that I can think of. And the only solution or the only reasoning I can think of is that maybe they were concerned that if they try to do it Mario and Luigi style, or even Paper Mario style, that they might not be able to draw things on the screen in the fidelity that they would want to. Because, there is some difficulty sometimes in terms of scaling the characters and, you know, giving a proper sense of depth, especially when you're going to be jumping around. I mean, the thing is, isometric, in some ways, was the 3D of its day. And there were games that were presented...
Sonic 3D Blast, it was 3D in the sense that it was isometric.
Exactly. Isometric is a way to fake 3D with 2D graphics technology. And so it might have seemed that for doing a platformer, a Mario platformer, but with the kind of world that you can actually explore more than you can a real 2D Mario platformer game, it might have made sense that by putting in isometric, they're actually expanding the possibilities and it enables them to create, you know, a more immersive, a bigger world, a world that feels like you can actually run circles around there and really explore it in a way that you never could before. I mean, this was before Mario 64. So it was a big idea at the time.
It's interesting because, of course, you know, all these, the actual locations in the game are usually pretty small. They're all in these little, like, vignettes, almost. Yeah. Like, you know, obviously there isn't really, like, a proper overworld or anything. It's all on the menu. Mm-hmm. And then when you go into the locations themselves, they're usually split up into rooms, really, even if they're exterior locations.
I think that's partly due to the pre-rendered thing again.
Yeah, well, the pre-rendered thing, now this gets talked about a lot. You know, people look back on it and say, oh, you know, it hasn't aged very well and all that. And it hasn't. And I think the pre-rendered aesthetic in general that characterised this period of the 16-bit era has aged well. at all. But the particulars of this game's graphics, I thought at the time, looking at the magazines, I was following it very eagerly at the time, I thought that the characters just looked wrong back then. Yeah. I mean, because the thing is, it's just the models that they use to actually, to make the sprites. They're not authentic. They look Bowser, Mario. I mean, you compare those pre-render models to what you see in the Mario 64 art, months later. they look like sort of Chinese knockoff plastic toy versions of actual Mario. It's just the dimensions, the particulars are just not quite right, and it's kind of that kind of lends itself to the inauthenticity of it a little bit as well.
They do all kind of look a little squished.
Yeah, but the squat.
I guess I'm not as affected by the whole graphical style thing. That it seems to be a real turnoff for people to go back and play it now. But I mean, I think if you can look at such things objectively, I do think the Virtual Console version is easily the best looking version. I mean, if you plug this thing up on Super Nintendo, it would not look as good on the new TV. So I mean, it's not going to look better than it does on Virtual Console unless they just completely remake it. And I don't know, playing it, that might have bothered me the first few minutes, because I hadn't played it in a decade or whatever. But now that I'm halfway through it or whatever, I don't think about it.
It doesn't bother me, really. My point really was just that I didn't think it looked hot back then.
It doesn't bother me, but I don't think it's a good looking game. I think that the music holds up far better.
The music's really good. And you know what? I think that's probably the one area I'd say is I prefer it to its successors, if you want to call it that. With Mario & Luigi and Paper Mario, I think it's got the best soundtrack.
They definitely are successors. I mean, we have the director of this game, or the co-director of the Mario RPG, was director of Mario & Luigi. And they had the same composer, so...
Yeah, Shimomura, as you mentioned, in the Games of the Decade submission. But I think the thing with the Mario & Luigi games is they're wonderfully whimsical soundtracks, and they're very appropriate, but just for music per se, I prefer this music. I think it's very effective what they do in Mario & Luigi, but just it feels a bit more particular. This is just good music in general. There's good weaving of Mario themes in there. You'll spot stuff from Mario 3, Mario World. Obviously the classic themes or the underground theme are in there too. But there's good original stuff like the Forest Maze theme or the Clouds theme. Really, really good stuff.
Well, I want to pull in some more forum posts here. Hero of Time 113 posted, "This is one of my favorite games ever. The way that the story is presented, the music, and the characters make it so endearing. The battle system is really great, with the timing playing such a big part, almost as if it's a rhythm game. More games should have that system, though a good one to check out is Eternal Sonata, which has a blocking system that is similar. I really wish that the characters, especially Geno, would make an appearance in another game. I'd love to see them in the next Smash Brothers game." Now, I guess other than, what other characters would you put in a Smash Brothers type game other than Geno? Maybe Booster probably doesn't make sense because he's so much like Wario. But I guess you could possibly do Smithy or something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about Smithy is another...
He's not a character until like the very end. Like, you don't meet him.
He's like referred to and stuff, but a number of the antagonists are kind of funny, like Booster, who seems bemused by normal things, which is weird. Like,
right. Crying.
Exactly.
Let me taste your tears.
Very, very weird. But, so there's a few like funny ones along the way, but it lacks the real persistent, sort of strong, funny villain that some of like Bowser in Paper Mario, or Fawful in the Mario & Luigi games. Someone who's like there, a sort of consistent, sort of agitator that's funny. Smithy isn't that at all, and the game doesn't have that. So that's that. I think that's a bit of a weakness. But I don't think anyone really likes Mallow that much, do they?
No.
Even he's a really important character, but he's just not like that much to him.
He's just
really
kind of the Slippy of this game.
Yes.
Or the he's supposed to be a fraud, Jar Jar right? Binks of Mario RPG.
don't say that, man.
So also the Axum Rangers. Here's a post from I think this is Kaitem89 posted. I really like the Axum Rangers. I like how they're portrayed as evil doppelgangers to the Power Rangers. It was kind of interesting to fight five bosses at once, and the phrases that each member said when they were defeated were just hilarious. My only disappointment was that the Blade airship did not transform into some kind of mech for your team to fight, and instead just fought the head of the ship, Blaster. Yeah, I think there is kind of an implication that the airship might transform and then it doesn't.
Yeah, you never know. It could have been just cut out or something. It's not infeasible.
True. But and that's back when Power Rangers were highly relevant, at least in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They were quite popular in the mid-90s. So it was surprising to run into the Axum Rangers and basically fight the evil Power Rangers in your Super Mario RPG. And to me, that was the moment when it got the farthest away from the Mario mythos and got into some kind of weird Square influence there. It's like, what am I doing? This has nothing to do with Mario, but it's still awesome, so I don't care.
Well, there was definitely some good localization in this game. Mm-hmm. I think we can attribute a lot of this game to a lot of kind of what Bowser has become in terms of his personality.
Yeah.
This was kind of the first time Bowser, you know, spoke or had any sort of featured role.
Speaking
other than being
of
the boss.
I have another forum post about that. Gojira said, "This is the first Mario game to give the characters any kind of personalities. The most prominent for me would be Bowser. I remember it was such a big deal to have Bowser playable, akin to recently with Sonic being playable in Smash Bros. And Bowser being a hapless bad guy is still prominent today." So yeah, he agrees with you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's true. And it's one of the best things about it, Bowser's bluster and all that. It's, you know, did big time in Bowser's Inside Story. It's kind of the logical kind of conclusion to it in a way.
Don't say conclusion, just continuation.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, destination, sure. But, you know, he's got the arrogance, but at the same time, you know, he doesn't want people to, like, perceive his weakness. And he has a little haiku, which is always good, if anyone remembers that, where he talks about, I can't remember the specific word, something about these fools will never see my intelligence or something. It's really weird. But he is definitely a strong point, and I can't help but have him in the party, even if it doesn't make that much sense, because it's just cool to have Bowser, and he has a chain chomp. I mean, what more do you want?
So, let's find another good forum post here. We had a lot, and I do want to say I probably won't be able to even read all the ones that I pulled out of the forum thread, but this was probably the best participation we've had in Retroactive yet, and I really appreciate it. And that forum thread will stay open, and actually I plan to, I say this now, I plan to keep playing it, even though this will be the only week that we have a formal segment about it. John will probably mention it next week when he gets back, because I know he's been playing it a lot. But I hope to continue playing it and actually beat it. I've never beat it back in the 90s, so I'd like to actually beat the game and continue discussing it in the forum thread, so maybe we can even keep this going. But Yoshi1001 posted, "Regarding Peach, while she does have the typical female RPG character healing moves, she does not have the typical ranged weapons you see. She gets in there and takes it to the enemy, sometimes with her nearly bare hands. Aside from the Mario 3 cartoon, this may be the best princess." That's a great point, because when we were talking about how this, you know, how much this game did for Bowser as a character, but it did do a lot for Peach. And you know, Peach before now had never really been an entity. You know, she was just kind of the MacGuffin. Yeah. And it was a big deal that you would actually get to play against her. Of course, this was the precursor to things like her having her own DS game, to her being playable in a lot of things, including Smash Brothers. And she's a far more prominent character in some of the Paper Mario games later on. So
doesn't she have a frying pan in Smash Brothers?
Yes,
Melee or Brawl?
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
She does, yeah. And that started
it's one
from
of the Smash attacks.
That started from RPG. So
yeah.
it's actually kind of nice that they took this opportunity to flesh out the characters. I would say the one character they didn't flesh out that much was Mario, because he doesn't speak. So
I'm sure that was a Miyamotoism.
Yeah, I mean, you get a
although Squareism too. The often in these RPGs, the main hero is kind of
I mean, Chrono's the silent protagonist too. I mean, it fits really, and he gets to do the pantomime stuff, which is really quite funny. It's kind of like acknowledging, like, we can't have him speak, so we're gonna do this. And it works. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it didn't feel unnatural to me.
Yeah.
But I mean, with Peach, I mean, one of the weirdest things, going back to it now, is like, this is probably the last time she's referred to as Toadstool. And not, right. Or, and she's not even referred to as princess. It's just like Toadstool joined the party or whatever. Like, it's really non-feminine. Like if you were
very
completely
that's her last name.
If you were completely unfamiliar with Mario and you were just seeing that, it's like, why is the woman in pink being called Toadstool? This makes no sense at all. Because it was just after that, the Mario 64. That was the first time they ever called a Peach in America.
Yeah, I have to wonder if this is like how Miyamoto found out that they had changed the name. But but actually, there is a reference to the fact that her name in Japanese is Peach, because when she's eaten by what is his name, Bellome. Bellome?
Oh, right.
And it says, Peachy.
Nice. Yeah. That's pretty good localization there. I mean, that's impressive. I'm pretty sure Square localized this for Nintendo.
Yeah.
And they did do a really good job. It's actually funny in a lot of places.
And to be fair, it's critical. I mean, it is critical that this has that whimsical, amusing edge to it, because it is straightforward. And if it didn't have that, it would fall flat on its face. And
it'd be
much
really
as
dry.
That, and as much of that is the Mario characters, the kind of physical action, all that, quite a lot of it is the writing. It's one of those first times where that's like a linchpin of the game.
Yeah. All right, well, speaking of funny, Golden Phoenix posted, "This is easily one of my favorite games of all time. I remember when it first came out how the interactive battle system grabbed me and still does. It is a perfect blend of RPG and action-based combat. The game is funny and has some great enemy art designs as well. What I enjoyed most was a good integration of secrets, including the special armor." I guess she's referring to the lazy shell. Well, there are really two lazy shells. One's a weapon, one's a piece of armor, but... I think that goes into what I was mentioning earlier about finding the Chain Chomp and Booster's Tower. I mean, it's nice that you sometimes find these important pieces of equipment, you know, that are pretty well hidden and can make a huge difference in combat if you actually go to the trouble of finding them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, the other things like that, I mean, like, you can get some really quite useful items just from those frog coins.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to go out of your way to go and spend them at the pond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never bother with those frog coins. They just seem
That's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, it really, the way the game is set up, it doesn't feel like this that it requires you to find a lot of secret stuff or even to level up very much. I mean, I tended to play through at full speed ahead, really. Didn't necessarily stop to do a lot of battles. And the reason is because I wouldn't get stopped. You know, if this was another RPG, what would happen is I would do that, and then I'd get my ass kicked, and then think, all right, I'll have to go back and you know, fight some more of those optional battles to actually get on par. Whereas in this case, I think on this playthrough, even more than the first, because I knew what I was doing, I actually played up past the Yardovich battle. This is for the fifth star. This is the go after the pirate ship, which is a pretty epic battle. It goes on for quite a while. It's quite taxing, but you got past that and never really had to stop and think about you know, grinding or anything approaching that.
On that topic, Halbred, which is Zach Miller, of course, from our staff and from the newscast, he posted in the thread, "Yeah, the shark boss did require some grinding. Is that Yardovich or is that..."
The shark boss is before Yardovich, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah,
so a lot of people seem to think that was probably the hardest moment in the game, the shark boss. But anyway, Zach continues, "Luckily, his dungeon, the shark's dungeon, is crawling with high XP baddies, so it's not a big deal. He might be the toughest boss in the game, not counting a certain Monster Town secret boss. Even Smithy isn't a big deal if you've got the lazy shell on Peach." Now, that is a trick I wish I'd known when I rented this back in the 90s, because I got to Smithy and got my ass kicked and never could beat him. So.
Well, I guess the thing is, if you've got if Peach is, like, unkillable, like, then she can always heal everyone else.
Right.
And then I guess that's how you pretty much become unbeatable. I mean, Smithy, I remember, goes on for quite a while.
It was a few long phases, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just on the subject of Smithy, I don't know, I didn't pull in a whole lot of quote here from Maxi, but Maxi in the forum had several posts regarding an experiment he was doing where he tried to beat Smithy with every possible combination of playable characters, and the hardest being Mario, Geno, and Bowser, because none of them know healing spells, so he had to rely entirely on items. But he was actually successful in beating the game with every potential combination, which must have taken hours, because that is a long battle.
That is... unnecessary.
Yeah,
well, well, certainly is that.
I consider
that's the best word I can use for it. Unnecessary.
I consider it taking a hit for the team because it is actually a pretty interesting experiment, and the result is interesting to me in that it shows that the game is actually balanced pretty well. You know, a lot of people say, well, Mallow sucks, or Geno's not strong enough, or, you know, Bowser's special moves aren't really useful or whatever, or Peach is overpowered. Mm. A lot of people seem to think Peach's healing is just too good in some ways.
It is really useful.
Yeah,
it's,
sure.
It's almost like the cup of life. You drink from it and you're immortal.
Yeah, and it never goes empty. But,
yeah.
But you know, I think Maxie's experiment actually proves that all of the characters are viable, certainly, if you keep them leveled up. And depending on your strategy or depending on your approach and depending on the kind of items that you bring in, it is possible to beat Smithy, the final boss of the game, with any combination of them. That's pretty cool. I mean, that's a long roundabout way of going to show that the game actually is pretty well built.
Well, I'm not sure I'd use the word that it proves it's balanced. I would say it proves that you can, in theory, beat the game with any combination of characters.
Let's say it proves that it's not unbalanced.
No, because we can't tell if he had to grind any more for certain character combinations than others.
He said they were all about the same level, 27, 28. And actually, characters do gain experience when they're not even in your party, so they're going to level up pretty evenly.
Yeah, you can switch them out pretty easily. Yeah. It's a question of having the upgraded most
it's
the best weapon that you can get at the time.
Sure.
It's not an issue of like taking the effort to develop them or anything like that. Like would be some RPGs, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, go back to the shark boss. If it's the one I'm thinking of, I think he's called Jonathan Jones, which is an interesting name for this podcast. I actually got caught out on that battle because I was fighting it, and he's got his little shark henchmen, and then I got rid of them all, and then it's like, okay, I'll challenge Mario one-on-one, and I guess I was a bit under-leveled, probably, as I was going to say before, and Mario one-on-one just couldn't beat him. Mm-hmm. His attacks were useless against him, I just lost.
Yeah.
And so I come to it the next time, and I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to leave one of those henchmen alive, and they never go one-on-one. It's not like it forces it at some point.
Huh.
If you leave one of those henchmen alive, you never have to face him one-on-one, which left me with your more capable party members to kill him.
Yep. Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of cool that you could like learn from your mistakes and try a different strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the boss battles, actually I think almost all the boss battles are pretty interesting. And even going to the very first one when you're fighting Bowser in the prologue and you have to attack the chain instead of Bowser.
Yeah, that's
right. That really prepares you for what the game is going to be throwing at you. It's going to mess with RPG conventions here. So that's a nice kind of tease that like, hey, even if you've played our Final Fantasy games, you can't just use those same, you know, tactics. You actually have to pay attention here. And you know, in later games, and certainly in the Mario and Luigi games quite a bit, as well as Paper Mario, when you get to a boss, it's probably a good idea to move the cursor around and see if there's anything else on the screen you can hit, because a lot of times they will do that kind of thing. And they did that quite a lot in Chrono Trigger as well, actually. There were some bosses with sort of secret weak points that don't necessarily look like they could be hit. So I really like that. And I think the bosses in Super Mario RPG, although it's weird because, you know, they couldn't really, I guess there wasn't that much material to draw from in the Mario universe in terms of bosses. And so, you know, most of the bosses in the game are, you know, original characters. There's stuff like Balome and Bowyer and stuff like that, you know.
Don't forget the wedding cake.
The wedding cake.
Oh, yes, that's great.
Yeah, there's some really strange stuff, but I think most of those battles are interesting.
Don't forget the great bit of buffoonery in the wedding sequence where they all go, where Peach goes to kiss Mario and then they all go to kiss Peach and everyone ends up kissing Mario.
Well, I think it depends on how well you perform.
It does.
Yeah,
that's a highly variable scene there.
With the finding these four thingamajigs, like a crown and a...
Yeah, in my playthrough, I just did this today. Mario missed Peach and Booster end up kissing Mario instead. So, yeah, I meant to preface our whole discussion with this, but I had to start from the very beginning with this, even though I played up to Booster's Tower when the game first came out on Virtual Console, and unfortunately my save file was deleted when my Wii had to be repaired, and I didn't realize that. And so once we started getting into this for Retroactive, I was like, oh man, I didn't even realize that my save file was gone, so I had to start from the very beginning. And so despite having 2 or 3 weeks to do this, I didn't get as far as I would have liked. I had a lot of other games to play, but I did play the game quite a bit. Just I was expecting to start halfway through, and instead I had to start over completely. So I didn't get as far as I would have liked, put it that way.
Yeah, I started from the beginning as well. I mean, I did play through it on this virtual console, and I've still got my save file, but I could sort of peek at the end as well, just remind myself of that. But I mean, it's good to play through the beginning just to kind of see how the game will kind of, you know, the pacing of it and how it all fits together. I mean, compared to a lot of RPGs played from the beginning, I think it's weird because it's so linear, it doesn't necessarily have that much replay value, or because it doesn't have like a bunch of alternate endings like Chrono Trigger. Right. But on the other hand, because it is brisk and it doesn't, you know, the start doesn't like dwell for ages to establish that the world's an idyllic place, but it's not going to be for much longer. I'm like, most RPGs do, I think it's kind of more replayable in that because of that.
Yeah, I think that's I was surprised playing through the beginning yet again that it went by a lot quicker than I was expecting, and it was not unpleasant. You know, I was kind of dreading having to trudge through the first couple hours, and actually I really enjoyed it. So I think you're right on the money with that.
I think it's a hallmark of all of the Mario RPG games.
I don't know, Paper Mario started a little bit slow for me.
Slower, definitely. I've only played that once, but it felt slower.
Well,
to me.
I think both Paper Mario games, well, really all three, if you count Super, are pretty ploddingly paced. That's actually
super
my
paced.
Major
Super,
you know,
Super is exceedingly ploddingly paced.
Yeah, that's
wow.
My major complaint with the. I do enjoy all three of those games, but I think the pacing is not that great.
Fair, I guess I agree.
It's really good in Super Mario World.
I enjoyed Paper Mario, and I enjoyed what I played in Thousand Year Door. But yeah, Super Paper Mario, the pacing is all over the shop. It's
especially with a lot of there's a next world, but you have to go, you know, traverse town to get to it.
Yeah,
I guess you should clarify what I meant when I stated. They don't have this front-heavy, like, 10-hour period where everything is perfect, hunky-dory.
No, they don't do that.
Things usually go right into it, is what my point was.
Exactly. Yeah, as somebody who just completed his fourth RPG in a couple of months, I hate that part of the RPG period.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine you would.
Because at this point, like, I've seen more worlds just get all kinds of effed up. At this point, it's like,
yeah,
you know what?
Just like,
it's
cut to the chase. Can we get to the apocalypse already?
It's like, I see this guy, and I know that his whole life's about to go to shit in about 2.5 hours. Can we just get there?
Yeah. And that's one of the great things about Super Mario RPG. You know, the first scene in the game is Mario invading Bowser's castle to rescue Peach. I mean, it's what you would expect to be at the end of the game.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Dracula X Symphony of the Night thing, isn't it, actually?
Okay.
You know, because you start Symphony of the Night with the end of Dracula X, which is Richter versus Dracula.
And it's the same kind of thing with Lufia 2. The first one.
The first Lufia does that.
Where you start with the end of the second game, which really fucking ruins the second game. But
what I really like about it in Super Mario RPG is they take your expectation of what, you know, Super Mario RPG, you hear about it and you think, well, it must be this kind of long quest for Mario to rescue Princess from Bowser, and they get that out of the way right off the bat, and the rest of the game isn't that at all. And in fact, Bowser and Peach both become party members, and you end up fighting this guy that you've never heard of before. So I actually really, really like that upheaval of the mythos that Square brought to it. And it does make the game feel very quirky and weird, you know, and it just, right off the bat, they're like, oh, check this out. I mean, can you imagine in a Super Mario platformer playing Bowser in the first stage? That's exactly what you do in the RPG, though. I think it's really cool, actually, the way they did that. All right, Doc Octorok. That's actually a great name. Doc Octorok posted, it's really a crime that this wasn't released as a GBA or DS game before becoming a virtual console title, because these models are so ugly on my LCD TV.
Oh, they're hideous.
And they
would
have looked fine on the small screen. That's arguable, you know, that may not actually work out as well as you think. There are plenty of bad pre-rendered handheld games.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Exactly. I do think it goes beyond the pre-rendered. I just don't think the art's that great.
I just think the art team fell down at the Switch, basically.
I played the game. When I plugged in my Super Nintendo to play a bit of this game last week or so, I used a CRT, old school tube monitor, TV, and you know it still looked kind of blurry and
I think that's just the way it always looked.
Exactly. I agree. This game never looked good. It never had good art, but you know that's not really a big problem.
I will say though, if you blow it up on a big LCD like he suggested,
you're putting the magnifying glass to it.
I think it looks fine on mine. I have a 37-inch widescreen. I even have it stretched out to widescreen, and I still think it looks fine.
Yeah, God, I hate that. but if you compare this with like Donkey Kong Country, I think Donkey Kong Country and the sequels still look pretty good.
Yeah.
At least on a CRT, they still look really good.
I think it's because of the art, though. I really do. I just think it felt more right.
They did pre-rendering here and then basically did nothing with it, essentially.
I still feel like, you know, that in some ways it was just like, I mean, you know, the verity of it is unclear, but yeah, you know, the stories about what happened with Yoshi's Island, you know, the up high Yamauchi, they wanted it pre-rendered and they were like, no. And so then when it came with this game, it's like, yeah, let's do it pre-rendered because we don't really care. Because DKC was this commercial phenomenon, and it's like, you know, pre-rendered is the hotness, and it's gold.
Yeah,
that's
right.
So it ended up getting foisted on this game when, you know, was it appropriate? You know, I mean, you look at what Square did. You know, we did Secret of Mana for Retroactive. That, even though it's an earlier title, holds up really well.
It looks
the visual
really good.
Department. Yeah. You know, Chrono Trigger holds up really well.
Final Fantasy V looks good.
Okay.
Well, by comparison.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's interesting because Square was just getting into the whole pre-rendered thing. They took it to a whole different level with Final Fantasy VII. And that's a game, again, where even the pre-rendered parts don't look that good now.
At the time, they were
amazing. But yeah, you go back to them now and it's like, this doesn't even... This is the best looking part of the game, and it still doesn't look that good, you know. But
no, and the best part of that game is you see the clash of pre-rendered and non-pre-rendered,
right.
And you realize why pre-rendering isn't always a good idea.
Right? Yeah. I mean, in Super Mario RPG, at least everything is pre-rendered.
It's consistent.
Does seem, in hindsight, it seems like a bit of an odd choice for Mario, you know, because Mario is a very cartoonish character. Why not just stick with that? But again, that maybe they just wanted to make it distinctive. As Greg says, it was kind of the fad at the time. And I'm sure it wasn't a decision made lightly. That was expensive technology back then. I mean, this was considered high production value if you had a pre-rendered game like this.
Which is ironic because it's a cheap and dirty way to do it now.
Yeah, no, at the time, it was that was one of the more expensive kinds of games you could make would be to do it with pre-rendered style, you know, and Rare invested a ton of money to do the Donkey Kong Country stuff. That was a big risk for them. So, you know, Square, they were gearing up, obviously. They were building giant farms of Silicon Graphics machines in Hawaii, and, you know, this was I think Mario RPG might have been kind of the front of the wave of pre-rendered for Square, because they went to the point of making their own movie. And certainly a lot of in-house CG for the Final Fantasy series on PlayStation, things like that.
I guess they were making the investment anyway, so there wasn't any additional costs in that sense.
For what it's worth, Square made an additional game with the pre-rendered SNES style called Treasure Hunter G, which is only released in Japan.
Right, I've heard of this.
Yeah, so, I think it's on Virtual Console in Japan.
Probably is.
Yeah, I've heard it's really good, actually.
Well, the music's fantastic. I don't know about the gameplay. Mm-hmm. I haven't played it before. I've you know, there was a barrier with the language, so I haven't checked it out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I don't know if there's an economies of scale thing going on there where they said, well, we did this for Super Mario RPG already, or maybe they had the technology and used it for two games at the same time.
Right.
I don't know, but it wasn't like this was the only game that Square used this on for the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, that's a good bit of trivia there. Thanks. Well, all right, it's time to shut it down. You guys have any final thoughts on Super Mario RPG? And again, we'll probably talk about it a little bit next week with John, so it's not like we're burying it, but...
we won't talk about it ever again. F it.
It's a historical game. It has some merits. I think it's what has led after this game that really is memorable to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I will say this was my first genuine introduction to the RPG genre, so
yeah.
I'm sure I owe it a good debt of gratitude because I went from that to Dragon Quest and some other stuff.
Right. Yeah, you went from that to Dragon Quest 8.
No. I had played 1 and 2 on the Game Boy Color.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm being unfair to you.
Yeah, I said this would have been my introduction to the RPG genre. It wasn't. But, I mean, yeah, I think in many ways it's really laid the foundation for the Mario & Luigi games, which are, I feel like, the fullest expression of, mm-hmm. of kind of what they started here.
Yeah.
But there's lots of good things about it. I think it's fun. It's definitely fun for someone who is not enamored with some of the trappings of the 16-bit era for RPGs. Otherwise, you know, like you know, random battles or yeah. the kind of cliche plot, you know, with the idyllic beginning and the apocalypse in
or
the middle.
Heavy grinding.
Or grinding.
Which is more of an 8-bit thing or even before, but...
And the additional interactivity of it as well, you know, but so it's a really suitable game for people that to get into RPGs and maybe, you know, once you get more amenable to some of the concepts that are there, you know, in terms of the turn-based battling and mm-hmm. things like that, then it can be a sort of bridge game in that sense. But, you know, that I guess that's the point, of course, now, if you don't have that context, it's not quite the same experience as it would have been at the time.
Right.
I think James and I think neither of us had that context even back in the 90s. I mean, James, you were like me. We played a lot of RPGs before this, right?
Yeah, I was probably my 13th RPG.
Yeah, I'd been playing since Dragon Warrior, if not even before that.
I just was going like, man, this is really simple.
Yeah, so you were never really a big fan of it. Like, did you feel like it was just kind of an aberration or like an oddity?
Yeah, I did. I was like, well, this is like a marketing game at this point. It wasn't that it was a bad game. I was just like, this isn't really, you know, doing it for me.
Right. So, did you feel that it wasn't really an RPG and it wasn't really a Mario game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I was.
I think that's actually probably a not unusual viewpoint on it. And I felt that way a bit. I think for me, you know, I was used to playing more, let's say, sophisticated and complex RPGs than this. But... for me, the simplicity was kind of a refreshing change of pace, you know? And I mean, I'm one of the only people who likes Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, and it's not because I'm too stupid to play real Final Fantasy.
Final Fantasy Dummy Edition.
I just appreciate the relative simplicity of it. I think it brings focus to other aspects, you know, and that's cool. You know, for me, it's very minor game, but it's not bad. You know, I enjoy playing it. And I felt the same way about Super Mario RPG. It's like, well, you know, this is simplified. And even at the time, I felt like I understood why they had taken that approach to it. And I was cool with that because I enjoyed exploring the Mushroom Kingdom, which you'd never been able to do before. So that was exciting for me to get into the fiction of it. You know, and I was certainly at that time young enough to actually get into the fiction of... you know, a game like this. I mean, I remember daydreaming about the Kingdom of Zeal. So, this wasn't that much different. You know, the idea of running around the sewers and going to Frog Island and Booster's Tower. I mean, it was very, very interesting to me at the time. And then I think also the platforming parts of it I really liked. I mean, that was certainly something you'd never seen before in an RPG. Nothing even close to that. So the idea of incorporating these Mario elements, like jumping on enemies, grabbing a star and running around and getting level ups for it.
Yeah, that's cool.
I thought that was awesome. Like that. Yeah. So I appreciated the uniqueness of it and the concoction of RPG stuff with Mario and the fact that it was a less of a real RPG, or at least what we thought of as being that at the time, never really bothered me, you know. But again, it's not a game I went out and bought. I was more interested in the Final Fantasy VIs and the Chrono Triggers and, you know, the obscure Enix stuff, because we weren't getting Dragon Quest during those years in America. But I was more interested in those games, and Super Mario RPG was a game I probably rented it 2 or 3 times, but it just never... I was never all that concerned with needing to own a copy of it or anything.
Well, it would have been expensive to buy it, as expensive to buy any RPGs of the day.
It was, yeah. They were quite an investment. And I used to rent a lot of RPGs, and that's Maybe we can have that conversation another time. That's logistically an interesting thing when you're dealing with cartridges.
Save file-wise.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Anyway, that's going to draw it to a close. Thank you for listening, and especially for everyone who participated, played along, posted in the forums. I hope you'll continue to do that. And we'll probably hear a little bit about the game next week from John, but otherwise, I'm shutting the book on Super Mario RPG. Stay tuned for details on the next retroactive. We'll probably take a little break and get around to it maybe sometime in March. So, that's the end of the show. Before we go, thank you, TYP, for subbing in this week.
Well, you're welcome.
I've talked to you a lot the past week, and I'm not sick of it yet.
I guess that's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
And I don't remember if we mentioned this at the beginning of the episode or not, but Johnny and I actually recorded an episode of Radio Trivia together, and I'm slowly getting through editing it. So be sure to check that out.
I think it's a
lot of fun.
It's a good episode. It's a lot of fun. I picked the songs out, and TYP had to guess.
One of those.
It's
fun. Shoes on the other foot now.
I don't want to spoil the results, but TYP is good at his own game. Let's put it that way.
It helps that I used to play it when you were hosting, and I know what games you like.
Nice. The mind games, the game within a game.
There's always a bit of psychology in it when I'm choosing. Yes, I realize. We know each other a bit too well. But, check out the NWR newscast as well. They just had a fun conversation about Blaster Master Overdrive, and I think they might be continuing that. They're teasing upcoming Game Club edition for Cave Story, which... that should be a lot of fun if the game ever...
Cave Story has to oblige.
If it ever comes out.
Takes two to tango there. So we'll see if and when that happens. Please do send your thoughts on Retroactive and anything else we've talked about, anything going on in the world of gaming, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we'll see you next week when John comes back. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I guess it's time to move on, so we're going to take a break, and when we come back...
What are you doing?
I know mine's going to be brief, but...
No, I just totally forgot it.
It's a little beyond brief.
Whoa, guys, come on. That was a terrible John impression.
Oh, gosh.
Stingerific.
I still like this John better.
Yeah, I'm pretty good.
You're going to do that Mass Effect one as well that was referenced. I think one of the forum guys brought up that. It's not Mass Effect, it's Mass Effect.
Mass Effect.
Mass.
Oh, Dead Space. Not Dead Space.
Dead Space.
Pause. Effect.
So, Greg,